Now we're going to read the scriptures together, and it's Psalm 30. It's entitled A Psalm, A Song for the Dedication of the Temple, Psalm of David. I will exalt you, O Lord, for you lifted me out of the depths and did not let my enemies gloat over me. O Lord my God, I called to you for help, and you healed me. O Lord, you brought me up from the grave. You spared me from going down into the pit. Sing to the Lord, all you saints of his. Praise his holy name, for his anger lasts only for a moment, but his favor lasts a lifetime. Weeping may remain for a night, but rejoicing comes in the morning. When I felt secure, I said, I shall never be shaken. O Lord, when you favored me, you made my mountain stand firm. But when you hid your face, I was dismayed. To you, O Lord, I called. To the Lord I cried for mercy. What gain is there in my destruction, in my going down into the pit? Will the dust praise you? Will it proclaim your faithfulness? Hear, O Lord, and be merciful to me. O Lord, be my help. You turned my wailing into dancing. You removed my sackcloth and clothed me with joy, that my heart may sing to you and not be silent. O Lord my God, I will give you thanks forever. Now the hymns which we have sung this evening, or songs, whatever you want to call them, are very relevant to this psalm. They were not chosen just because they might be popular or ones that we sing well. And what we have to do first of all with this psalm is to seek to place it in its context. Some of you for Christmas may get a book and it will say it's an autobiography written by the person themselves. And that's what's happening in this psalm. Psalmist had been writing about his life, and we are able to look at just one small chapter of it. And we shall see in it all the emotions that he felt. The unwelcome darkness, a morning of sunshine, something temporary, something internal, a sad memory, a joyful anticipation, a weeping and a gladness, anguish and anxiety, finishing with blessedness and relief. And I still intend to finish on time. Now, the way that I look at this psalm is to actually put flesh on the words. And change the words into people. And it's a psalm where two guests come into a person's life. One is unwelcome and stays too long. The other guest is very welcome and is asked if he would like to stay forever and ever and ever. Now, this is set to be a psalm of David and to form part of the celebration of the grand opening of the temple in Jerusalem. Well, we know that the temple was not built during the reign of David. It was his son Solomon, the king of peace in the city of peace, who built the temple of peace. So, perhaps they recited this psalm on that occasion because it speaks of the ups and the downs of David in his life, his humble beginnings, all that he went through, and how he finished as a king. And that's what they wanted really to emphasize. So let me introduce you to the first guest. Imagine that you're settled down for the evening after a very busy day in your favorite comfortable chair. And then suddenly there is a knock at the door. And in your house, you can peep round the curtain to see who it is. And to your astonishment, it is someone who you do not get on with particularly well. And then, worst of all, you see the guest carrying two suitcases. Well, you answer the door and you know what's coming. And you let him in. Having let him in, it's very difficult to get rid of them again. And what you discover is this: in no time at all, he is making demands upon you. Can I have the largest of the bedrooms, please? There's no shame about this fellow. What's for supper? In the morning, can I have the bathroom first, and I will tell you when I've finished. Now I'm retired, I've got used to the full English breakfast. Is that a possibility too, tomorrow morning? And I usually have morning coffee about 10:30, if that's not going to be inconvenient. And the guest that you have invited in has now become the dominant person in the household. And it's very difficult to challenge him. And the guest that you've invited into your house is called trouble or adversity. And you have let him in. And the psalmist says, I let that guest in. Now, we all have difficulties in life, and there are often great tragedies, just as the family in New Zealand have experienced. And other situations come into our lives. Last Sunday morning, when I was at a church, I was expecting to meet a friend. He's 89, slightly older than I am. And he wasn't there because he had developed bone cancer. And he has been promised a pain-free Christmas. And for all I know, and he suspects it, it may be his last Christmas. And then to my astonishment, I was talking to a young couple, and young lady, 30-ish I would have thought, had an arm in a sling. Well, you don't normally ask ladies what's wrong with them, do you? But I thought I would try, and she didn't have much to say. But then I was told she has bone cancer and is so weak she cannot hold even her baby. Her husband carries the baby for her. Now, these people didn't ask for that kind of thing to come into their lives. Great adversity and trouble. But that is not what this psalm is talking about. When things like that happen, and other tragedies, we know that God is able to give us special grace for that time. We don't need it on other occasions, but we need it then. But this psalm is about a different kind of adversity. And it's what we bring upon ourselves. Something happens and we say, I can't blame anyone else but myself. Now, how do we know that? Because the psalmist says so. In different translations, he says this, in my complacency, in my self-assurance, I let a guest into my life and it was very real adversity. And I've no one else to blame but myself. Well, this is a psalm by David. So in what way did he feel self-secured before he allowed adversity to come in? Well, one of the easiest ways to do this is to contrast him really with another king who came before him, whose name was Saul. I think Saul is a very sad man really to read about. He undoubtedly had courage, but he really didn't have the leadership qualities. You remember that Saul was chosen because he was head and shoulders above everybody else, until he met someone else who was head and shoulders above him, called Goliath. And then he was not so brave. But David comes along, the youth, and slays the Goliath. Saul lived in a fortress in Gibeon, but it was David who established a new capital city, Jerusalem. Saul fell out with Samuel, but David was a patron of the prophets. He welcomed them. The Ark of the Covenant was never safe while Saul was king, but David brought it nearer to Jerusalem. At the time of Saul, the tribes, like clans, were quite scattered. David unified all 12. He was king in Hebron for 7 years, for some of the tribes, and subsequently he became king over all 12 tribes. Saul was not organized. David begins to arrange for districts to be formed, and he even started taxation, and the Solomon followed the same pattern afterwards, and I think that's one of the reasons for his downfall in due course. Saul had very little credibility in the end, but David had great credibility. He was always fighting the Philistines, and not many people realize this, but as you read the Bible, the Philistines had cornered the iron market. And if someone in Israel wanted to have a plough made of iron, he had to go to the Philistines to get it. So they were really still in the Bronze Age. So if the Israelites went to fight with their bronze swords, they were no match for the iron swords and the iron chariots of the Philistines. Saul died a very ignominious death, which we won't get into details now. But David, overall, was a man of faith. So we try to put the psalm in context. If we read a psalm and immediately go to the 21st century to interpret it, we've missed so much. So now we know that David was feeling very pleased with himself, and then his field marshal, Joab, oh, a very hard man. You know, he could stick the knife in you and smile as you dropped in front of him. And he said to David, "You've been fighting very hard, but things are well now, so I suggest to you that you don't go out to war anymore. Stay at home, get out the wine glasses, and relax." And so he did. And then often when Joab had done most of the fighting and it was nearly over, he would send a message to David, "Now you come out and lead your troops into battle," where there's, you know, so that David got the credit. But then, of course, in his relaxation, this is when David really allowed adversity to come into his life. One evening, when he could not sleep, he decided to get up and walk about. And who did he see? It was a woman called Bathsheba. And to David, she was voluptuous. And that's a word that means sensually, pleasurably. And as there are people under 18 here, I shall say no more, but those who are older and read the Bible, you know the rest of the story. First the sin, then another of intrigue, and finally leading to murder. And he thought he got away with it, but he was a patron of the prophets. And Nathan comes along and tells him the parable of the man who had one ewe sheep and a man who had many. And the man with many took the one, and David was furious. And Nathan said to him, "And I'm talking about you." And that is when David began to see that his life had changed, because he had been making decisions without thinking about what God may say, not even talking with wiser heads who have told him not to do it. And so he goes downhill. And if you want to know the way he felt, then you can read the penitential psalm, Psalm 51. And it begins like this. "Have mercy, O Lord." And David went down into his personal abyss of trouble and adversity. Now, he couldn't say the Lord had done it. And he doesn't say so in his psalm. He says, "I have done this, I've made the decision, I've done these things, and I can blame no one else but myself." And it's very sad, really, because David had, of course, more than one wife. He'd even married a very sensible woman who could read him like a book, called Abigail, who had been the wife of the late Nabal. Her husband was a fool. She was the wise person in the marriage. And David married her. But that wasn't enough. Bathsheba came along, and that's when the trouble began. "Have mercy on me, O Lord, And you know, sometimes we send ourselves into a personal abyss of adversity because we are not thinking. I'm thinking now of a young man who went to the garage and saw this great gleaming beast with four wheels and all the up-to-date things that they put on cars. I don't mean a Ferrari, because when they're made, you know, they're all sold immediately. So we're not talking about 400,000 for one, but we're talking about a motor car. And he signed up and went home. And when he got home, he suddenly realized that he would not be able to make the repayments. And worse still, nor the running costs. And he began to experience the anxiety and the adversity that had come into his life. It will be Christmas soon. And I want to say to you, although it's many years ago now, I had Christian friends who went to the office party at Christmas and shamed themselves, and adversity came into their lives. And there's no one else to blame but themselves. With my own daughters, who are now in their late 40s, when they were at home, I devised a plan to keep them out of trouble. So if they were out with people and they telephoned me and said, is it okay for me to stay, or I'm thinking of staying over? Well, the signal was, if after that they said, please, it meant, come and pick me up now. It was the office party where recreational drugs were going round, and my daughter was there. The telephone call would ring, I'm ready for home, please. And that was a signal for me, you know, the taxi driver in families, and all fathers are, aren't they, to get down into town and to bring her home. And believe me, Leeds, at 1:45 in the morning, there are more people there than you'll ever see at Old Trafford or anywhere else. But then, of course, we sometimes commit our time and energy and money to some activity, but you didn't feel very easy about it at the time. And as time goes on, you become absolutely certain that, well, it's really not me. And then you face the anxiety and adversity of how to extricate yourself from it. And then there are people who bring trouble on themselves for other reasons. One of them is burnout. I know someone who, and these are true stories, by the way, I'm not making them up, involved in the Billy Graham Crusades, in open air work, taking leaflets out to houses. Whatever it was, he was doing it. And then he suffered burnout. He tried to get life assurance, and no one would give him it. And for him, life was very low. And so he burnt out. Age 21. Because he decided he was God's gift for evangelism. And he could do everything. Had he been here this evening, he would simply have picked up the box and gone with it. He'd have done it all before 3 a.m., you know, tomorrow morning. Even if he did the same row of houses twice, which sometimes happened. And so he was nowhere. Others who have gone to university and they've got involved with the Christian Union, which is a good thing, but they've decided again that the whole university must be evangelized, and their studies suffer. And they've forgotten they'd gone to university to gain a degree. And they would have 50 years after that for all their evangelism, and some of them do not survive. And I've also been with pastors who are overworked and don't say anything because conscientious men don't. And the congregation has not noticed that he's going downhill. And again, without going into detail, on a number of occasions, I have had to be involved to try and rescue the situation. Adversity. And all these people couldn't say, "Lord, why have you done this to me?" They had to say to themselves and to everyone else, "I can blame no one else but myself." This week I went to the doctors and it was a practice nurse really, and I'm in very good health for my age, except that my sugar level is rising high. Well, I just happen to like toast with Manuka honey each morning, and so of course it goes up. So I've had my warning, and her parting words were, "Now it's up to you. It's up to you." And it was up to David. It was up to the other people that I've mentioned to take the advice and to do something about it. Well, the psalmist did something about it. And if I've depressed you so far, I hope I'm going to lighten it a bit for you. Because another guest, the second guest in this psalm, is about to arrive. And the guest is eagerly awaited. You're now looking through the window for that guest to hurry down the path and to take his two cases from him. And it's all hearts and flowers and kisses. The favourite bedroom is ready. There's a vase of flowers in the room. The new duvet is there. And your guest doesn't make any fuss about anything, but you're so excited about them coming that you can't wait. And even the children in the family have received their orders. When our guest arrives, you will say please and thank you. You will not say to our guest, "We're only having cups and saucers because you're here." You will not run down the bedroom steps and jump the last four and shake the house. And if you chase one another around the house, there will be imposed a 30-kilometre speed limit while you're in the house. And I haven't made those up. And the sign on the bedroom door that says "It's my mess and I like it" will be removed. But I don't mind if the girls keep their posters of the hunk of the month on their bedroom walls. A mother wrote all these down and she placed them round the house so constantly her adolescent children could read them. And of course, when she knew the guest was coming, she very quickly went round the house and she collected them all in. Except one. And the following morning, the guest was heard to be laughing very loud because they'd gone into the bathroom and picked up a towel and read the notice, "If you touch these towels, I will kill you." And they were laughing. And the guest was laughing because they'd had children and they knew what it meant. What would a loving mother say to her adolescent children? If you touch these towels, I will kill you. I think we can say that her children would probably say, yes, she would. Now, David, in his abyss, began to cry to God for help. Nathan had pointed the finger, and David was about to come out of that abyss. And he did. And if you want to know how he felt, read Psalm 32, just slightly ahead of this one. Blessed is the man to whom God will not impute sin. Blessed is the man whose sins have been forgiven. Now there's a man who knew adversity, but is now realizing that a new guest was appearing called grace and joy. Let me read something to you where he says he's come out of it and we rejoice as well. Then King David said, call Bathsheba. So she came into the king's presence and stood before him. And the king then took an oath, as surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of every trouble, I will surely carry out today what I promised to do for you. Solomon, your son, shall be king after me. And he will sit on my throne in my place. Of course, he really meant our son. David was being restored. And then, in the same chapter, just slightly further down, Zadok the high priest, Benaiah in charge of David's 70 mighty men, and Nathan, who had accused him. There's this wonderful word, when David had finished, they said, amen. Nathan agreed it, the high priest did it, his mighty men agreed it, and so Solomon was made king. That's the way in which the adversity was removed. Well now, the person that I spoke of earlier, who had signed up for the motor car and couldn't afford it, he couldn't allow this guest to stay very long. So the following day, he went back to the garage and he said, I signed up for this car, but I can't afford it. And to his astonishment, the car salesman reached into his files and took out the contract and tore it up in his face and he said, thank you for coming in so soon. You needn't buy it. I'm throwing it in the bin. I'll sell it to someone else. Oh, the relief as he walked back to his old motor car. He could have hopped, skipped and jumped. Anguish wasn't very long. The student who decided to concentrate on the studies got a good degree and then had a good 50 years of evangelism and commitment to a church. The exhausted pastor, where the church members saw it, agreed with him, the carefully chosen second pastor, to make a joint pastorate, but the first pastor felt he could stay. And I will be honest with you that if this church continues to grow as it is, then in due course, we may well have to think. I'm going to say this, but we really will have to think about a joint pastorship, a partial pastorship to join in. Because there are only 24 hours in a day. And I have been in situations where pastors have been very desperate, and it happened to my duty at the time to immediately drop everything and go see them. Wives in great distress. But it could all be avoided if the church understood its duties. And what about the young man who was burnt out at 21 and couldn't get life assurance? Well, he started to recover. He learnt things in his personal abyss which he couldn't have learnt unless he'd gone there. And he did get life assurance. And for the next 50 years, he had the best health record for the company that he worked for. He took on extra responsibilities, but he had learned many lessons under God at that time. And so, there's adversity, and then there's grace. Now, I finish with this. Sometimes, and it may be our dispositions of some people as Christians, we allow the first guest to stay too long. We need to draw back the curtains and let the sunshine of life come in and realize, yes, we live with regret. We all live with regret. But if it paralyzes the individual to the future, then he or she may need help to get rid of that unwanted guest and all the paraphernalia that he or she brought with them, in order that the grace of God come back into individual lives and amaze us. Now, you'll notice in the last two verses, the psalmist is getting quite excited because all the relief has gone. And he says, I can sing and dance, and we might translate it, I'm feeling rather giddy about this because it really is a wonderful time now for me. All that's in the past. The first guest has been thrown out. The new guest has come, and they can stay for ever and ever. And when we do make those errors, for which no one can be blamed but ourselves, and we need help to get out of it, then we'll rejoice when God's amazing grace comes along and does that for us. And so the past is gone, and the future becomes bright. So as you read the psalm, see that someone came in and is not wanted. There was confession and restoration, and the new guest came, and that guest could stay forever. So it's very positive. So may the Lord help us all to do the right thing, that when it comes to making decisions of some consequence, that we consult with him, and with wiser heads, and perhaps any adversity that comes with it will not be as great as it would have been had we acted on impulse and just by ourselves.